Here we go.
My name is Mahmoud Lavabidi. I'm 34 years old. Today is June 27th, 2018. We're located in Los Angeles, California. And I'm being interviewed by Eva from the Annenberg Space for Photography.
Excellent. So my first question comes from our photography category. So if you could photograph any person or event in America's history, what would it be?
That's a tough one. I do a lot of photography, and I think I would look for photographing some sort of moment that was behind the scenes. I think one of the more powerful images was Obama in the war room, kind of sitting back, as opposed to some sort of action photo. Like, there was a movie rolling right now of that captured Bobby Kennedy getting shot or something like that. I think I'd like to see the behind the scenes, the no makeup perspective of people. Any person, that's a hard one. But I would like to see how particular, I guess, leaders, whether it's Obama or whoever it is, or even, to be honest with you, even Trump, I'd like to see him without his crown on and see how he is behind the scenes. One of the interesting things is Obama was a smoker, but there's not really any photographs of him smoking. I can understand why, but I think that would be an interesting perspective to see him, you know, with all warts and all.
Yeah, interesting. So more personally, can you describe a family photograph that you cherish?
I don't have one in particular. I think it's because I come from a quote unquote broken home where my father wasn't around much, and so there are a couple photos that I have that I've photographed with my phone. They're originally negative film photos, and I photographed them with my phone, and I look at them every now and then, and it includes my father and my mother, and I think I'm in it as well. I can't remember if my brother's in it, but it has this kind of, it's almost like a fake photo in a sense, because I knew the reality of the family life was pretty, you know, pretty hard, pretty much just turmoil most of the time. And it's not so much that I cherish this photo, but I recognize as a photo shows a kind of a different side, something that's not normal, and it's something that I almost wish I had, if that makes sense.
Right, so the photo shows you something that looks like the thing that you wish you had, but you know that when you look at the photo, it's not that thing.
Right, exactly.
Can you describe one of the photos? What's in the photo, where you were, that
kind
of thing?
Yeah, I don't think I'm in the photo, but I think my mother and my father are in it, and there's a few other people just kind of sitting around. It's like the most benign situation where people are just maybe sitting around eating, maybe 1980s, you know, in 1980s fashion, permed hair, all that stuff. And it doesn't say a whole lot, and I think because of that, it says a lot. Like, it's not, you can't really tell what this event was. You can't tell who it was for. Was it a birthday? Was it just a gathering? And in a sense, like, that kind of speaks a lot about this family scenario.
If you didn't know the family in the photograph, what do you think you would think about the photo?
If an outsider saw it, I think they would just say, oh, this is just a group of people just sitting around, hanging out, maybe eating, maybe whatever.
Okay, so you had also mentioned that you are a first-generation American?
Yeah.
So can you tell me the story of how you came to live in the U.S.?
So I'll give my birthplace afterwards, but
okay.
Because
keeping us in suspense.
Yes. So I actually grew up in Kuwait until I was 7 years old.
Okay.
You know, my family is traditionally Syrian, is ethnically Syrian. We both sides of my parents are Syrian. But my grandfather had a job with the Kuwaiti oil company, which I think partnered with Shell or whatever it might be. And so he had a job in Kuwait, and that's where all the jobs were. It was a lot more lucrative than Damascus, Syria.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I lived up until I was 7, and we came to the U.S. to visit one of my uncles who was in school in Michigan. And that summer, the first Iraq war started. Saddam invaded Kuwait, so we stuck around.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to school that fall and never looked back at Kuwait. One of the questions that some people ask, are you a citizen? And I was like, yes. I was actually born in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Mm.
Because my grandfather, the one who lived in Kuwait, told my mom, basically, treat me like an anchor baby. Have me born here. But I think he looked well past that for my own future, not just hers. Because it was actually difficult for her to find a regular job. She had to find particular jobs that could hire people effectively undocumented. Mm-hmm. She was here on like a visitor's visa, which it was a long enough visa, but at some point it expired and so on. But one of the obvious jobs back then was in Washington, D.C. You could work at an embassy.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't need a visa to work there because it's effectively a foreign country. They've clamped down on that now, but so that's what my mom did until she got her green card.
So wait, how did everybody end up in Ann Arbor? The connection there?
Traditionally, Dearborn, Michigan is an Arabic place, very, very strong Arabic community, but Ann Arbor was where my uncle decided he wanted to get a master's and then a PhD. So my grandfather said, go ahead, I'll send you over there, and I'll pay for school. And he came here, did his PhD, and that was kind of like the home base. I think my grandfather bought a small condominium house in Ann Arbor, and that became home base. And my aunt came, my other uncle came and studied here, and then from there, we eventually one by one came to D.C.
Hmm. Interesting. So your mom came. Had your mom spent a lot of time in the U.S. before she came here to have you?
No.
So she was just like, that was sort of your family's West settlement, where it was like, that's the place, that's the U.S. to your family, was Dearborn, Michigan, and that was sort of where you went to, where you would go.
Yeah, Ann Arbor, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
My grandfather had actually initially tried to get a visa to France. He asked France, can I come live here and be a mm-hmm. resident? And they'd said no, but the U.S. said yes. So that's one of the reasons my grandfather favored the U.S.
Hmm.
It would have been interesting to be a French person,
right?
In that way,
could have all been totally different.
But my mom had me at 29, so 7 years later, she's 36, and this was her first exposure to American culture and American life. So I grew up. It was an interesting time growing up. I always wondered, you know, I always looked back and wondered about certain things when I was a kid, such as, you know, it could be something as benign as, why aren't the other kids taking off their shoes when they come home? To something a little bit more intricate, where do you need to know that does your mom need to know that I'm at your house when she's not there? You know, if I'm visiting somebody's house
mm-hmm.
After school.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had to know everything I did.
Right.
And I think it was a cultural thing where everybody knew what everybody was doing. So that for not just for safety, but just out of nosiness as well.
Right.
But
yeah.
So it was things like that, and things with food. It was a lot of things.
Yeah, that was my next question. What was the most surprising thing about the U.S.? What do you think? So you sort of answered it a little bit from your perspective. What do you think? You mentioned your mom having to make that transition. What do you think were some of the most surprising things for her about living in the U.S.?
I think it was culture. I think just the how do I put it? I don't want to sound like I'm portraying it negatively, but just things such as, you know, like to this day she'll comment about tattoos or this, yeah. You know, or drinking. Like drinking's not a very big thing in Arabic culture. So I think that was kind of the biggest thing that she was surprised by. Even for me, I think generally a lot of things were roughly similar, but I mean, as a kid, everything's like, is not a surprise, but everything's wonderful in a way. Everything's this cool thing. Oh, we get to ride bikes in the street wherever we are. You know, that's the thing you think about when you're that age.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
What was your first day in the U.S. like? Do you remember what that was like, that first day?
I don't remember at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I...
How does your memory separate your time in Kuwait and your time in the U.S.? When you think about a timeline in your memory, how does that look?
I think everything centers around school, right? I think school is like such a big impact, whether you're in preschool, kindergarten, first grade, whatever. And so it's almost this transition where in the summer, I think I forgot what we did, but I think I remember vividly coming back after New Year's break. Second grade was the first year I was in the U.S. And just remember this, she was an older teacher, probably in her 60s or so, maybe, you know. And she said, it's January 2nd, it's a new year, it's 19, I think it was 1991. This is a new year, guys, so turn a new leaf. Like, it was just kind of this weird concept, like, what does that have to do with anything? if a bad kid's going to be a bad kid, he's just going to be, you know, like...
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, now, it's like looking back, it's like, oh, it's one of those boomer generation mentalities, like old 50s.
It's also very American, this idea that you can reinvent yourself all the time, is that we reinvent ourselves at every opportunity. And the New Year's a great time when everyone decides... the old you was terrible, and we're all going to focus on the new you. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. That's, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, whereas, yeah, I think other cultures would think that you this year are just whatever you've been building towards the rest of your life. So if you were a bad kid, so to speak, then you're going to be building towards this year's just another year in you continuing whatever that looks like. And, you know, whatever that story looks like. But I guess in this American idea, this year could be, you could start completely fresh. This is, it means something very different.
I wonder if it's realistic. Mm-hmm. If actually people do that. But yeah, I guess that was my first, not exposure, but maybe first times I thought about, you know, behavior, you know, as a kid. So it doesn't answer my first day in the U.S., but it answers kind of first moment of
right.
Thinking about behavior and so on. But yeah.
So you also talked about work. Well, what do you do for work?
At the moment, I have the title of a data scientist. Okay, so what that is it's basically a software engineer who can also do this other skill that involves using historical data to do predictions on new data,
mm-hmm.
right? The common examples are you could use speech, so you could do things with Siri and so on. Technologies that are similar to Siri where you're predicting what the person's saying, right? The other more complex approach is, you know, based on your behavior, the fact that you walk here or that you go here, you know, your phone knows you're about to go to this place.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly work in this realm of satellite imagery. So we're looking for objects on satellite images. It could be for commercial reasons, defense reasons, and so on. And so the reason I kind of wanted to talk about this was because I thought a lot about, you know, work, because it takes up, first of all, it takes up a lot of our time,
mm-hmm.
right? Secondly, kind of back to the American idea about you get to reinvent yourself, and that, quote unquote, only in America do you get to choose what path you want to take or what career you want, or you have the opportunity in some sense, and that it's your own fault if you don't go and succeed at this thing, right? But the problem is the reality. You know, I'm really, really, really fortunate that you know, I had uncles and even my father. He's a really smart guy, and genetically, I think I'm favored on that part. But also, we had cool stuff like computers when I was young, and all these newfangled technologies. So I was good at it. So I was really fortunate that way. But if you don't grow up with that around, you're kind of screwed in from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of unfair to think about this meritocracy that says it's your own fault if you don't make it. So I thought about that, and I thought about, what if I was in that person's shoes? You know, that had to work a quote-unquote regular job. And it's even more interesting visiting LA. I actually live in D.C., where a lot of people in D.C. They kind of follow this approach of, it's my own fault if I don't succeed. So they go after these quote-unquote superstar jobs. You know, these jobs that send them traveling all over the world or whatever it might be. And I think, being that I've had exposure to some of these things, I think I realized that a job at the end of the day is a job. You know, but it's not just the job that makes it worthwhile. It's the connections you make at work, whether you have a customer, whether you have people that rely on you, whether you have teammates, your boss, your commute, the building that you work in, the environment that it's in, whether you're on a cube farm or you're in a space that is a little bit more interesting. I think a lot of these things play into the psychology of how you feel about work, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, even people who have a lot of money still want to make, not necessarily they want to make more money, they want to keep working, right? They could check out and say, I'm done. And some people do. But I think a lot of people want to do something interesting with their time. And I think to them, it comes down to these deep questions about, what is it I want to do? And they're very hard questions, but I think a lot of it comes down to themselves and their relationships with certain people. So I personally thought about that like a lot myself, where I asked the following questions. Do I want to write code all day? Do I want to interface with other people who write code? And this is our kind of our medium of communication. This is our context. Is it something I respect, or is it just a tool? Like for me, I'm here in the space of photography. I like photography. I do photography. I like art, and I think personally, art I think is one of the most important things in the world. And so it makes me wonder, do I want to be in art in some way? If I'm not going to be an artist, maybe I work in the realm of art in some way. So I think about these types of questions a lot, because, you know, it sounds really selfish, but it's like, well, I have this time on Earth, you know, and, you know, just as a tree that grows and then dies off, it has some sort of time to just do what it wants to do. And what a tree wants to do is be a tree. And so for us, we grow into this earth, and we have our own selfish reasons of things that we want to do, but I don't see anything wrong with that. A lot of people are gung-ho about saving the world, and if that's something they really sincerely want to do, that's fine. But I think it's unfair to tell people, like, you should do something bigger than yourself. I think the most important thing is that this person who really loves this thing that they want to do it responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to go make art, if they want to work on cars, if they want to write a blog, if they want to get into fashion, do it, but do it responsibly. And I think that's something hard in the U.S. because we're inundated by a lot of media.
Mm-hmm.
To tell you that you're not good enough and you have to do this. That's one. Number two, we have an amazing system of credit that enslaves people to say, you want to go to art school? By all means, You're going to owe us $120,000 when you're done. And now what? You know, and so it's hard, but it's still available here in the U.S. I'm not sure. I haven't thought too deeply about how it's like in the rest of the world, but.
Yeah, well, I think it's that, you know, we talked about France, and I've been to France a couple of times. I haven't lived there, but I had a friend who lived there for a couple of years, and I think she talked about, I went to visit her when she went to university there. She got her master's degree there, and the school is free, so you can get your master's degree for free. And there they also have this philosophy of work to live, not live to work, which is very different from the way that we are. And they have lots of vacation time. And I know the school holiday schedule for kids is really complicated because there's a lot of long stretches of vacation time that everybody gets, regardless of whether you want it or not. Things are closed. You can't work on those days. And I think that that's just that's really different from here. It's here the expectations are going to work all the time. I also think about generational questions that when I talk to my parents about work, they have a very different concept of what that looks like than what my expectation is based off of the different things that have happened to the generations between me and them. And so I'm wondering if you've had conversations like that with people older than you, how do they relate to those sorts of questions that you're asking yourself?
Yeah, I've definitely had discussions with my family, my uncles, my stepdad, my mom, and I remember specifically just one time that I think I quit it was like an internship that turned into a real job, but I didn't really want that job, and I think I remember quitting, and then he just kind of gave me this quote unquote talk that was like, why don't you just stick with something, right? He became a CPA and he became an accountant and stuck with. He actually worked at Geico for 40 plus years, and he's on the verge of retirement. And to him, it's you work all this, and then you get this big payout in the end to retire. And so what did I do after I quit? Well, I stuck with something, but I did a PhD. Mm-hmm. And I claim my PhD time, my 6 years, was my best 6 years of retirement I've ever had. Because I never went into work saying, why am I doing this? I really enjoy doing it. But it was something that a lot of people question why I do this. Even my mom was like, you're going to do a PhD in physics? Are you crazy? She thought I was going to become a physics teacher. Career is going to become. Yeah, I mean, she wasn't sure. Again, it's like this, you know, foreign mom thing. Mm-hmm. She thought I was going to become a teacher. And it was like, you're going to go from being an engineer, a software engineer, to a teacher? Like, you know, it has this negative connotation, but it wasn't the case. I didn't really have any plan beyond that. And I think this generational difference, like I don't know, I can't really speak for the rest of, you know, anyone that's younger than me. I'm 34. I don't know what's going through their heads as much. I can only speak for myself, because I actually went and did something that I really enjoyed so much, but then I came out of it at the end exactly where I started.
Right.
Which is like, okay, what do I want to go do now? I'm still asking myself that question. The only difference is that I don't have something really pulling me. While the older generation, I think that their motivation, and I get it, was family. Mm-hmm. Right? One of my uncles who came here, he did a PhD. He was a research scientist. He had a decent gig as a research scientist, but it didn't pay well. So he went into pharma, right? Even then, at the beginning, it wasn't a high-paying pharma job, but he knew there was an opportunity to grow, and you know, and he earned a lot of money and sent his three kids to universities and grad schools and paid for it all, and it was fine. And so, I think that's one of the things that I see different is that I struggle with this identity between I do what I want to do, but at the same time, what about when I have a family? Mm-hmm. How do you balance the two? And I think you mentioned France. I think that's where things are a little different, where France, school's free, healthcare is effectively free. There's a third thing that they offer that makes life easier. Well, just in general, they make life for parents and families mm-hmm. easier. You
know? They have a system where they send person to your house that's postnatal care. So after you, this is what comes to mind, always just blows my mind, that they send someone to your house to be a nanny, but for you, basically. So after you give birth and you come home, it's chaos. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, family members would gather around and take care of you. And if that's not the case, or even if it is the case, they have someone there to make sure the laundry gets done, make sure the you are settling in well, that you're not experiencing postnatal depression, that there's all this sort of checks and balances, and then you get a certain amount of time and then they leave. And that's a service they provide, which is so far away from what we do here.
I mean, just if you walk around Paris, you will see there's playgrounds everywhere. Unlike here in the U.S., I mean, it's especially if you're in New York City, Lord mm-hmm. knows how many playgrounds there are there, but I think that right there, it kind of highlights this struggle in the U.S. where it's like, well, thanks for moving here, guys. Like, thanks for providing me with the best. But now I've been inundated with this image that I'm number one, mm-hmm. me first. Secondly, work is the most important thing, but yet I'm not finding the thing that's the most important to do. And so it really creates this conflict where it's like, wait a second, if you would just give me the image that work is work, find the thing that helps balance between paying your bills, giving you enough money to take care of your hobby, paying for your family, then we could do it. And having some sort of emotional or psychological relief when you come home from work,
mm-hmm.
you know?
What do you think your dream job looks like? All that considered.
I do enjoy solving problems. I enjoy connecting with people and helping them solve problems where I lead them into realizing, well, it can be on different levels of problems. So a lot of people will come in and say, I want to do this thing. And sometimes I get deep into it psychologically. I go, why do you want to solve this problem? Why do you want to create this business, for example? And they might say, well, it's an easy way to earn money, et cetera, et cetera. I said, great. I'm going to pretend that you just landed $1 million. Now what do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And then they come up with something totally different. So I like getting into the psychological problem solving in that way. And then I also like doing kind of really technical, hands dirty problem solving. So I think I enjoy that because I enjoy seeing, I don't know if there's a good word for it, but seeing people live without barriers, like their own kind of barriers, just doing these semi-selfish things that they want to do. If it's just to go play soccer, go play soccer, go play football, whatever you want to do. I mean, I don't mean serious, like professionally, but you want to go out and play, go play. You know, go have kids, and when they get age 7, you can go kick a ball with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we don't appreciate those things. We don't appreciate play very much.
Mm-mm. No.
Even like when you go watch sports, you realize, oh my gosh, this is all work. You watch a sport, and you're like, oh my gosh, how much do I have to work to do this? And if you want to buy a ticket, good luck affording a ticket to go see Golden State Warriors play. You mm-hmm. know. So that's my diatribe about work.
Any last thoughts about any of the things you talked about?
I think it's interesting to vocalize a lot of these things and seeing a common thread between them. I've never been able, like, I initially thought, oh, these questions are going to be, like, different and don't pertain to each thing individually. Maybe the photography question is one that the one offbeat question, but I think right. A lot of it kind of it's all interlaced. Family, work, you know, living in the U.S. I think one of the things I do, I guess, looking back at a lot of this is you asked me what would be my favorite job, and I didn't list anything about art about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason is because I don't want to list art as a job. right? It's something that you can't really put into words sometimes, because if you treat it like a job, it would become a job, you know, become mundane. I have to make this, I have to get up early and deal with, let's say you're a sculpture person, and you're making these big 50-foot sculptures. It's like, oh, I got to deal with the people who bring the metal, I got to bring, you know, this construction, etc. So that's, I think it's not so much what job would I ever want. I think it's what leisure aspect would I want in my life. And I think that comes back to what we're saying about family,
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, the leisure aspect of life and enjoying life with your family and being able to reflect and think about it. I think that's what I think is more needs to be afforded more in this country in general. So it's 2018. We'll see if we treat that as an end goal as opposed to profit. You know.
Cool. Well, thank you.
Of course, thank you.